The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Affordable Care Act, the Supreme Court, the Paris Agreement, those are among the questions of what kinds of changes a Trump administration will bring. And to that, we add a far less critical one, White House decor. Each incoming president is expected to make the executive mansion home. But how far can an incoming president go in putting their mark on the White House, an historic place that many traditionally feel belongs to the American people, not the family that lives there?
I hate to make changes, really. So when you find a room like this, it's wonderful.
That is First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy from a televised tour of the recently renovated White House in 1962. The special was broadcast on all three major networks and gave the public its first view of the $2 million renovation. 80 million Americans watched the program, and it was syndicated throughout the world. First families have a lot of leeway for living quarters on the top two floors of the 132-room executive mansion. And there have been some famous and infamous large-scale changes since the Kennedy makeover, which included the Rose Garden and a swimming pool. President Richard Nixon built a one-lane bowling alley below a driveway. Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter wanted to save money, so they skipped the standard redesign of the earth-toned Oval Office. Instead, Carter installed solar panels, which Ronald Reagan quickly removed. President Obama added a basketball court, and First Lady Michelle Obama put in a garden. We called Edward Langle, chief historian of the White House Historical Association, to find out what is permitted and whether the new president gets a moving allowance, like a lot of people do if they accept a job in another city.
Yes, they get a certain endowment from Congress to cover moving and to cover a certain degree of redecoration.
How much?
It varies from president to president. Mary Todd Lincoln back in the 1860s got, as I recall, $20,000, which she notoriously overspent, and it has gone up, of course, since then with inflation.
So how many rooms need to be furnished when a new president moves in?
Well, they will certainly refurnish the family living rooms. There are several of those. They will refurnish the state and family dining rooms. They will also, to some degree, refurnish the entrance hall as well as other rooms in the house. But the number that they actually work on depends on the inclination of the president and the first lady, as the case may be.
And these furnishings, do they get to keep them? I mean, maybe it sounds silly, but will the Obamas take the curtains or rugs and towels with them?
They can't do that anymore. It used to be in the 19th century, it was much more common for incoming and outgoing presidents either to change things willy-nilly, to even throw things out, or occasionally to take things with them. Sometimes they even sold items of furniture while they were president in order to earn money to buy new furniture. That is no longer possible. The furniture that's in the collection now is protected, as the White House has national landmark status, and the items in the White House, the furniture and the more permanent furnishings are all part of the collection. So they can't simply be carried off.
So I'm thinking about things that I associate with the White House. I've seen this photographs of a Steinway piano, for example, the George Washington portrait painted by Gilbert Stuart. So are these things that stay in the White House? They don't get moved around?
There are certain fixtures, like especially the George Washington portrait, that are pretty much always there and always in the same place, although presidents have occasionally changed the portrait to a different George Washington portrait. For example, since the Kennedy administration, there's been a portrait of Abraham Lincoln over the fireplace in the state dining room. But for the most part, there's so much furniture there already in the White House that the presidents really don't have any room to take in much of their own. The Obamas, for example, left all of their furniture in Chicago when they came in. So they may do things like change the color scheme of individual rooms. For example, the state dining room used to be a very dark paneled old Victorian decor. Teddy Roosevelt had even put animal heads up on the walls, so like elk and moose and bear. But after Truman came in, he decided he needed to lighten it up, so he changed the color scheme, changed the decorations.
And as to Teddy's trophies, Jackie Kennedy shared another take. Apparently, they were not universally admired.
Theodore Roosevelt hung his stuffed animal heads around the room. There's a story that President Wilson so disliked these stuffed heads that he always seated himself in such a manner that he would not see them while dining.
The Trump administration is sure to bring a lot of changes, among them White House decor. Edward Lengel is chief historian of the White House Historical Association. He's talking about how other first families have put their mark on the executive mansion over the years. Historically, it's often the first lady that plays a great role in designing or redesigning the White House. And Melania Trump has said that she will not move into the White House in January so their son can finish the school year in New York City. So where does the First Lady fall into this redecoration or redesign?
Traditionally, First Ladies have played a major role both inside and outside the White House. And for example, the First Ladies since Edith Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's wife in 1904, have played a major role in redesigning the White House gardens. Ellen Wilson, Woodrow Wilson's wife, changed that and installed a lily pond. Lady Bird Johnson redesigned the East Garden and named it after Jackie Kennedy, and she, of course, created the Rose Garden in 1962. So they've had a major role there. They have also, for example, when the first family enters the White House, the chief usher of the White House will typically take the family, including the First Lady, all over the building and show them where things are, how they've been designed, where furniture is stored, and we'll work with the First Lady to change color schemes, to change arrangements. So that'll be a big change for a First Lady not to be involved in that, as apparently will be the case.
The Obama family's renovations were praised for their design aesthetic, and they were featured in Architectural Digest. Are there any other first families that really hit it out of the park?
It's been changed profoundly since the very beginning. The Lincolns certainly hit it out of the park. They had encountered a White House that had become profoundly run down over the previous decades, many decades of neglect. Mary Todd Lincoln, as I mentioned earlier, spent a lot of money to refurbish it. She brought in a laminated mahogany bedroom suite, including the Lincoln bed that's still there today. Chester Arthur in 1882 created this big 338-foot Tiffany mosaic screen in the entrance hall, which sadly is lost. It was apparently a beautiful piece of work. But in modern memory, the family that did the most was clearly the Trumans. When Harry Truman came in after FDR died in World War II, there really wasn't much time. He didn't have much time to make any changes. But the White House had become so decayed by that point that the chief usher said it looked like an abandoned hotel, and he gutted the whole building. He and Bess Truman completely redesigned the interior. Much of what we see today in the White House is indeed a creation of the Truman family.
How about decorating missteps? I mean, you mentioned Mary Todd Lincoln spending a lot of money. Did that become an issue?
That was an issue at the time in terms of the amount of money that she spent. It wasn't exactly what I would call a misstep. Certainly, there was such a rage for tacking on things to the White House in the early 20th century that it created a number of structural problems. The Calvin Coolidge administration in the 1920s installed a third floor as well as solarium. The weight of that created so many structural issues that it caused floors and walls to sag, and was one of the reasons the whole thing had to be torn up again just 20 years later.
I'm actually doing a home renovation project myself, so I'm curious any about other home improvements undertaken by First Families, you know, real building construction besides Calvin Coolidge.
Well, of course, Teddy Roosevelt created the West Wing. Teddy was such a fascinating president in so many ways, but one of the things that he changed was he shifted the White House from being more purely a working space to a family space. He was so family-oriented. He was notorious for turning the White House into a huge playroom. He would go racing up and down the halls with his children. Part of the reason he had the West Wing built and he expanded the family living areas was so that he could create a more home and family-friendly space. And then his successor, William Howard Taft, installed the Oval Office in 1909. Those are some of the major changes, but some have been controversial. The last exterior change was again by Harry Truman. At the end of his renovation, he created a balcony over the South Portico that was so controversial that he couldn't get a bequest of money from Congress for it, so he used money from the household budget to build it.
Well, we've heard a lot of jokes circulating that Trump is going to gild the ceilings, mirror the walls, you know, make them look like one of his hotels. Any real sense of how he'll make the White House his own?
We've even had suggestions from people that he might want to change the color of the White House to some other color. There's clearly a lot of wonderment about what's going to happen. The White House, as it stands now, has got such a beautiful and amazing collection of historic interior decoration that it would be impossible to plunder that or to replace it profoundly with some other items that are non-historical. I would be shocked if he would attempt to, for example, build a major new addition to the White House. It simply would be very structurally difficult and incredibly expensive.
Well, let's leave the last word to a great tastemaker, Jackie Kennedy, who clearly did not equate the presidency with good taste.
That's the oldest thing in the White House, the only thing that was here since the very beginning. The government set a rather interesting precedent when that picture was painted. They commissioned the finest living artist of the day to paint the president, and then they gave it as a gift to the White House. I often wish they'd followed that, because so many pictures of later presidents are by really inferior artists.
Thanks to Edward Langle, Chief Historian of the White House Historical Association and author of several books, including First Entrepreneur, How George Washington Built His and the Nation's Prosperity.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Election 2016 was a bitter slog, and while many Americans looked forward to the end of the ads and mailers and campaign rhetoric, that bitterness did not simply dissipate once the results came in. In the days of street protests and spike in hate crimes that followed, many Americans searched for signs of hope or messages of comfort, and some found them underground. Activists in New York City encouraged commuters to post notes on subway platforms. Soon the walls were covered with colorful squares scribbled with positive messages like grit or love or offering post-election encouragement like you belong here or do yoga. Others more philosophical. It is a big project of small gestures called subway therapy, and it's since spread to Boston, thanks to my guest. Vanita Subramanian is a user experience designer and an urban activist. And Vanita, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So how'd you get things started? Did you seed some of your own little messages to get it going?
So Subway Therapy Boston started as a last-minute project on one Friday afternoon, and quite honestly, we did not expect the overwhelming response that we received. In an effort to keep things positive after the elections, a bunch of friends and I mobilized to provide a medium for the people of Boston to just come together and share words of love and encouragement. This, as you mentioned, was inspired by a similar effort in New York. And what we did was we headed to two busy subway stations and offered riders a simple proposition, which is write a positive message on a post-it note and, well, just post it. So in just 8 hours, we received over 2,500 posts of love to the community, which to me was quite overwhelming. The notes range from personal messages, admiration for Boston, to inspiring quotes from political leaders from around the world. And what was surprising to me was that 99% of all of the notes that we received, it stayed positive, with exception to maybe 4 or 5 notes.
Wow, that really is something. Out of how many do you imagine?
Like 2,500 something notes. So that was, you know, it was crazy. And participants were, any of hate messages that they saw, they quickly transformed it into something inspiring or quirky. And now what we're doing with the help of volunteers is archiving all of the notes and uploading it to our website. So we have 200 up there so far. And with the help of our volunteers, I hope we can get as many as possible.
Were any stick out as favorites for you, you know, that really made you think?
There were so many of them, and one that caught my attention is reach out to someone you disagree with, because, you know, every now and then we need to challenge what we believe in, and that was something that really resonated with me. Some of the other ones that were admiration for Boston made me feel so proud that I'm part of this community, and I actually moved to the city about 3 years back, and it's been one of, you know, the best decisions of my life.
So why the subway, Vanita? I mean, what is it about that space that makes it work?
I think it's because you meet people from all walks of life when you commute, and you don't see that very often. You know, when you look at a private space, I met some Trump supporters. I met people who were just visiting Boston. I met all sorts of people, like high schoolers and, you know, college students. So it's just a place where everybody needs to take the train to go home, and, you know, they stop by, read the messages on the wall, and, you know, feel the urge to contribute.
Well, it's interesting because this is something that people do on other people's Facebook walls, you know, post something, some little message. How is it different?
It's different because I feel like we're always in this virtual realm, that it's nice to just, you know, take the time off and have some in-person time with one another. Like, I met a lot of people through this project, and I know a lot of strangers who started voicing their opinions out with other, you know, people who also stopped by to admire the project. But it was a place where people could just unknowingly share their thoughts, and in some way it is therapeutic, you know, a way of self-expression. And I think that's why it's unique. Like, having a community engagement projects, in my mind, is more unique and engaging as opposed to also having it online, which I think is a plus. So what we're doing now is to have these messages reach a larger audience through our website. So I think, you know, having both an in-person sort of engagement process as well as having something online has its benefits.
So do you think it's, you said, therapeutic for the reader, for the writer, both?
I'd say for both. You know, there were people who came and who participated who were basically in tears. You know, they were just reading the messages on the wall and they just started crying. And I was like, wow, this actually has such an inspiring effect on so many people. And then they came up to us because we were handing out posters and, you know, just thanking us, saying that this, you know, I needed this. You know, I feel like there was just so much negativity in the air, and I just reading these messages makes me feel like I need to do something positive and I need to keep thinking positively. So I think it was therapeutic for both the reader and the writer.
But it's, you know, it's a country that's facing some very big decisions and divisions.
Yep.
So, you know, somebody might say, oh, post-it note, that's a very small gesture, you know. Mm-hmm. What are your hopes for a project like this?
You know, I was equally surprised because it was such a small gesture, and it's like a collective impact that you can have. I guess if you just see one post-it note with a message on it, you know, you'd read it, you'd think to yourself that, okay, that's a sweet message. But if you see thousands of messages on one wall and 99% of that being positive, that should have some effect on anyone reading it, regardless of, you know, what political affiliations you have. You know, it's just a human gesture at the end of the day.
Well, Vanita, thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me.
Vanita Subramanian, she's a user experience designer, urban activist, and founder of the Subway Therapy Project Boston. You'll find a link to the website where you can see some of the post-it notes from the wall at the Boston Tea at wordofmouthradio.org. Reports of hate crimes have soared since the bitter national election. Black lives don't matter and neither does your votes was spray painted across a wall in Durham, North Carolina, a day after the election. That same day, two students at a Pennsylvania vocational school were videotaped parading with a Trump sign shouting white power. A flurry of swastikas and variations of Trump Nation, whites only, has popped up on public buildings. All of these incidents have been confirmed or under investigation by law enforcement, as have several incidences of harassment and intimidation of Muslim women, including forcing them to remove their hijab. Others, like this YouTube post from a mall parking lot in Memphis, have not been independently verified and may never be reported.
White power!
A.C. Thompson is a staff writer for ProPublica, and Ken Schwenke is a data journalist. They've been tracking the surge in hate crimes for ProPublica and how difficult it is to track and even report these kind of crimes. Ken Schwenke, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
A.C., so glad you could join us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So that video was posted on November 7th, just before the election, and I've seen reports of surges in hate crimes before and since the election, but what does the data actually say?
So the data from the FBI's UCR report has upticked, and those are actual reports that have been reported to the police and then further reported up to the FBI. In New York, the NYPD has said that hate crimes have ticked upward, and they're actually creating a special unit, according to the governor. The statistics on hate crimes are sort of poorly kept, but from what we know, they appear to be tracking upward.
Okay, how much upward?
You go back to the most recent year that we have full data available, that's 2015, and what we see in that FBI nationwide data is we see about almost a 7% increase across the board in hate crimes. But then when you look at anti-Muslim hate crimes, that's where you get the real extreme rise. And so that's a 67% increase there in 2015. So that is going to be with the beginning of the presidential campaign.
So Muslims clearly targeted. How about other groups? Who's being affected?
You know, it's interesting because there's a very high number of anti-Jewish hate crimes, and those were up 9% in 2015. High number of crimes against African Americans, those were up 7.7%. Crimes against Latinos, by the numbers, look unchanged, about 300 of those nationwide. But the other really big category here is crimes against people due to their sexual orientation. And so you had more than 1,000 of those.
Well, it's been a lot of concerns about fake news stories that are shared on social media and get picked up and spread all around. So what did ProPublica use to track these kind of claims and numbers for accuracy?
So far, we have looked into so our story was mostly about the publicly available data sources and how those are sort of inadequate. What we're looking to do now is to track reports from social media using a process we sort of perfected or started with Election Land, which was a project to track people's access to the vote. That involves looking at social media sources from, say, the Southern Poverty Law Center and other organizations that track that, and combining them in a way that we can sort of catalog them and track them.
What's inadequate about the numbers?
Yeah, so when it comes to the numbers, right, the FBI statistics rely on two things. A, that you reported them, and B, that the police then reported them upwards. Well, I guess three things, because also that the police adjudicated it as a crime, as a hate crime. We know that people don't necessarily report hate crimes because they're very personal. And in fact, the DOJ has estimates where they think up to 200,000 to 300,000 hate crimes may occur a year, and the vast majority of them go unreported to the police.
So these are federal offenses, right?
No. So what we're talking about here is both federal and state offenses. And in the case of the FBI data, what they're really looking at is state and local law enforcement. So they're looking at state cops, local cops, who should be documenting alleged hate crimes and then referring that information to the FBI. And what we find is that there are states that just don't participate at all. Like the state of Hawaii doesn't participate in this hate crimes collection project at all. And then there are states where the numbers are highly dubious, and frankly, I don't believe the numbers. So Alabama in 2015 said there were 10 hate crimes in the entire state. Arkansas said there were 5. Mississippi said there were 0. And I frankly don't think those are real numbers. I think what's happening is you have a problem at the front end with police officers actually documenting these incidents as hate crimes. And then you have a problem with the local and the state law enforcement agencies actually forwarding this information to the FBI like they're supposed to.
Oh, so let me just play this out in my head. So there's a fight at a bar, and the cops are called, and somebody was calling the other person in the N-word or something like that, and that started the fight. The local law enforcement is making a decision right there whether or not it was a hate crime?
Yeah, exactly. And what the federal law says is basically, hey, if there's a crime that's predicated on a dislike of somebody's race, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, et cetera, you need to collect that stat, and or at least the FBI needs to collect that stat from the local and state law enforcement agencies. But the law doesn't compel the local police and local sheriff's deputies to actually submit it. So you have a sort of system where the FBI is supposed to go out and get it, but the local police and law enforcement don't actually have to submit it or submit accurate data on these crimes.
So they're not compelled, but is learning about hate crimes or preventing hate crimes a part of training for most local police or law enforcement?
In California, there's real training through the police academy system about hate crimes. Other states define hate crimes differently. So, for example, Alabama doesn't have a hate crimes law that protects gay, lesbian, transgender folks. And so even in terms of police going out and seeing what would be considered a hate crime in California, they're not going to consider certain incidents in Alabama a hate crime. And so I think training is absolutely a thing. Also, there's just no unification of the state laws. The state laws are all over the place.
I'm speaking with ProPublica's A.C. Thompson and Ken Schwenke, who've been tracking the surge in hate crimes for ProPublica and found that it's difficult to get an accurate count. Given these kind of gaps in reporting, do we know that there are more hate crimes happening, or are there just more being reported since the election?
So it depends, right? So if you go back and look at the FBI statistics, many places never report, right? And so it is hard to get an exact level on whether hate crimes are going up or down all over the place. But we do know that a number of hate crimes reported to the police and then further reported to the FBI have gone up. And we do know that in places like in New York, right, the law enforcement agencies there have said that they have seen an increase at their local levels, and further organizations that track this, such as the Southern Poverty Law Center, have said that they have seen an increase in reports to them.
You mentioned New York Governor Mario Cuomo. He launched a toll-free hotline to report incidents, set up a hate crimes unit. More than 400 calls since it launched last Friday. How are other officials responding in other states?
You know, it's interesting. A lot of states have been very, very quiet about this, and I think a lot of Republican officials and people, for example, in the Trump sphere have really not said a lot about this. There is a theory that's circulating on right-wing websites that these hate crimes are all sort of a conspiracy to discredit the incoming president. So that's the sort of state of discourse in some places.
Well, how has the Trump campaign responded? I mean, some of these are directly connected to Trump's victory, some claiming very overtly, you know, now that our man Trump is elected, it's time to organize a vigilante squad against diversity. Several students at UPenn received invitations to a daily lynching last week, now that Trump is president. So how has the Trump team responded?
I don't think we've seen any real response from the Trump team. You know, I think if you're an incoming leader, there could be the risk of overblowing clearly a negative story and blowing it up. But I think also as a incoming leader, one of the things that you want to do is say, hey, you know, I was elected and I intend to be the president for all people here. And I don't really think that that has happened in regards to speaking out against hate crimes by the current incoming administration.
Well, readers are invited to share their tips or other information on hate crimes to you, is it, AC?
Yeah, that'd be great. It's ac.thompson, T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N, at propublica.org.
And we'll put a link to that and the article by Ken Schwenke, data journalist with ProPublica, and AC Thompson, who's a staff writer. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Here's a scary scenario, an asteroid hurtling towards Greater Los Angeles.
What is this thing?
It's enormous.
It's an asteroid, sir. It's the size of Texas, Mr. President.
What kind of damage?
Total, sir.
My God.
Nothing would survive.
And no, this is not the trailer for a Hollywood blockbuster, but a worst-case planetary protection exercise conducted this fall by representatives from NASA, FEMA, the Air Force, and other government agencies. The group simulation was designed to run through likely consequences, defenses, and on-the-ground responses to an asteroid colliding with a densely populated region. Lindley Johnson is Planetary Defense Officer at NASA HQ. And Lindley, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So scientists in this simulation knew the asteroid was on course to collide with the Earth since 2016, four full years before the simulation. Would we likely have that kind of advanced knowledge?
Well, that's sort of the whole purpose of our program here at NASA, is to find well in advance any asteroid that might be an impact hazard to the Earth far enough in advance that we would have time to mount a deflection mission.
And would there be enough time to do anything 4 years on?
Well, 4 years is pretty tight, and that's why in this exercise we weren't able to do anything about it before it would impact the Earth. Of course, this exercise was designed for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and so, of course, we had to exercise them and their processes and procedures, we had to have something impact the Earth.
Okay, so when you say we couldn't do anything, we couldn't send a team led by Bruce Willis to destroy the asteroid. So what are the other possible means of deflection or interruption of an asteroid bound for Earth that NASA has worked through?
Well, one of the first fallacies of the Hollywood movies is sending a crew to an asteroid to do this. That would not be necessary at all. It would be done by robotic spacecraft. And there are two leading techniques that we call them for deflecting asteroids. One is what we call a kinetic impactor deflection. That's just hitting an asteroid with a spacecraft enough to change its velocity by just a little bit. And that's really the whole basis of doing a deflection. You just need to change the speed at which the asteroid is moving so that 2 or 3 years down the road, when it reaches the same point that the Earth, it is late to the encounter.
So do we have kinetic impactors on hand?
No, we have nothing that is permanently ready for this. It's really not necessary. But we are developing those types of capabilities and demonstrating that these techniques could be effective. We have in our development now a mission called the Asteroid Impact Deflection Assessment Mission. It's a collaborative mission with the European Space Agency to demonstrate the effectiveness of a kinetic impactor.
So in this scenario, this exercise this fall, how big was the asteroid heading for Earth?
Well, when we first detected it, we didn't know exactly what the size would be. That's part of the challenge of this, is as we first see these objects, we only see a point in light moving across the sky, and it takes more observations over time to be able to determine the size and composition of the asteroid, and therefore the mass that we would be dealing with. That's probably the most important parameter, is understanding how significant the mass is of the asteroid, because that then determines how much force you have to apply against it to change its velocity.
Mm-hmm. And how about the projected damage, you know, the impact once it hits Earth in this, you know, greater LA region for this exercise?
Yeah. As the exercise progressed, we learned more and more about the asteroid. One, by doing a flyby mission of it, quickly sending a spacecraft out to flyby it and gather as much information as we could. And through that process, it was determined that in this hypothetical scenario, the asteroid was only about 100 to 120 meters, about 300 feet in size. But even so, that, you know, that's the size of a football field. And an object that size hitting in the middle of a metropolitan area would pretty much wipe out the entire city.
What if an asteroid were heading straight for an American city? Well, that disaster scenario was played out by NASA, FEMA, and other government groups in an emergency planning exercise in California this fall. We're speaking with NASA's Lindley Johnson, filling us in on what they learned there. What if it hit right off the coast?
Well, then if it would hit in deep enough water off the coast, that could cause a small tsunami wave to inundate at least the low-lying areas along the coast.
I'm seeing things here, you know, equivalent to a 50-megaton explosion, large shock wave, devastate the region for miles around, leveling structures for how far around?
Oh, out to about 10 miles, most structures would be leveled. It's the speed at which these objects are traveling. It's traveling at about 12 to 15 miles a second, and all of that kinetic energy being released as it hits the Earth is what causes it to be an explosion equivalent to a large nuclear device.
Well, of course, you're doing this. NASA participated in this with FEMA and other agencies. So FEMA, they come up with a plan to evacuate, what, 18 million people living in the area?
Well, that's one of the challenges they might be faced with, given this type of scenario. One of the things, though, once we detect the object, we can pretty precisely tell them when it's going to happen so that they have sufficient time to plan such an evacuation. Also, protection of critical infrastructure, shutting down oil pipelines and things like that.
Well, Lindley, the FEMA administrator, Craig Fugate, said of this, you know, it is critical to exercise these kinds of low probability but high consequence disaster scenarios. So how low probability? What are the real chances of an asteroid of that size striking the Earth?
Well, luckily, an asteroid that size would not happen very often. Of course, the Earth gets hit with small stuff all the time. The meteor that you can go out and see every night in the sky, or the very small end of these natural objects. An object 100 meters or so in size, luckily an event like that might only occur once in 1,000 years. However, we don't know when that next event is. And so that's why our program is mainly designed to survey what is out there to give us as much advanced warning as we can. Objects down to 100 meters or so in size, our estimates of the population show us that there could be as many as 25 or 26,000 of them that are in orbits that come close to the Earth's orbit. And we've only found about 7,000 of them so far, so we have a little ways to go with our survey efforts.
Yeah. Well, we remember, you know, the asteroid exploding over this Russian city, Chelyabinsk, in 2013. Remember, you know, of course, caught on all the dash cams, shattering windows.
That was an object only 20 meters in size.
So just imagine 300 feet. But, Lindley, if this is such a low probability, I mean, why so many simulations? This must cost a lot of money.
Well, we've not had so many simulations. We've had three in a period of about 6 years. And also, these are simply tabletop exercises where we design a scenario, a model, what the effects might be, and then and gather a group of experts in a room to present them the elements of the scenario and discussion then about what needs to be taken into account, what the challenges might be, and where they should focus their future planning.
So if anything is heading for us, you're going to let us all know, right?
That's our job here at NASA, is to find them as early as possible.
Lindley Johnson, NASA Planetary Defense Officer, thank you for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
You can find links to more on NASA and FEMA's emergency planning meeting for asteroid impact. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. If you like what you heard, we invite you to share stories and segments with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep list of our archives to listen to. You can post them on social media or email them to friends. And let us know what you are hearing from your circle of friends and colleagues and sources. What are you curious about? What are you finding interesting? Or what is scratching at your sense of wonder? We find that the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. Please keep sharing them and join us again for Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.